This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are women victims of climate change?
There is actually a misconception that, and this is a statement that has been circulated in the literature and policy domains for years now, which goes back to actually an unsubstantiated claim. And the claim is the following. It says that women are 14 times more likely to die in natural calamities, which seems horrific. Well, what we found during the work we have done, including myself with colleagues for the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was to actually show that this is only true when these women are also socioeconomically disadvantaged and when disasters actually exacerbate existing patterns of discrimination.
Take a trip with us to Africa, India, Australia, and Europe as we explore who dies during climate-driven disasters and why.
Of course, as often, infants and children are most vulnerable, and it can negatively affect learning abilities and IQ for children. It is a severe toxic compound.
Also in this program, from his lab in northern Sweden, scientist Eric Bjorn explains why the neurotoxin methylmercury will pour into the seas as climate change progresses. Will climate change affect women more than men? Is it really a gender issue? To get one view, I've reached Professor Petra Tjeckert. She's a geographer who specializes in adaptation, marginalization, and political ecology, among other things. She's published a slew of papers and book chapters while working on challenging projects abroad. These days, Petra is a professor at the UWA School of Agriculture and the Environment at the University of Western Australia. From Perth, Australia, Petra, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Fantastic.
Now look, there's a lot we can talk about. I'm interested in your fieldwork in Asia and Africa and the way you research rural people. But first, I'd like to approach how women appear in reports about climate change. We have economists, governments, and the United Nations saying women will experience greater impacts, but how do they say it?
This is a really interesting question, Alex, and I think it's an important one, and it certainly deserves attention. Women have appeared in the climate change literature actually over the last 20 years, but the way women have been portrayed has changed dramatically. Initially, there was very little attention to women in general in the climate change debate, in the literature, the scientific literature, but also the broader literature, what we read in newspaper articles, and what we call the gray literature. And the same was true for indigenous populations, for example. So to counteract the what we call the invisibility of women and other marginalized groups in climate science, women mobilized and really brought women to the table on all kinds of climate issues, but particularly originally to the table of the United Nations Framework Convention, the UNFCCC, that is the policy arena for all climate change. And so what happened was all of a sudden there was a lot of attention to women, but the flip side to that was that it produced, if you want, what we call an essentializing, stereotyping image of women who were portrayed as most vulnerable to the impacts, the negative impacts of climate change. And that is, of course, simplifying the story. So what we saw was a switch from ignoring women altogether to overemphasizing, if you want, the vulnerability of women around the world without any distinction of where they would live and what their other conditions in life were.
That's one interesting thing that you've done. You've looked beyond the identification of women to see these subsets, you know, women without education or persecuted ethnic women, all with their own problems, even before climate becomes disrupted. Take some time to explain why that matters.
It matters because, as we have seen with the advancement of the literature, that people who are most vulnerable are not one particular group, so not one particular gender, one particular ethnic group, one particular racial group. What we see is that people who are most vulnerable are those who are excluded from decision-making in societies, who don't have a voice, who suffer, who are exposed to persistent inequalities, dynamics of marginalization, dispossession, domination, these are the people who are most vulnerable. And so what we see is, in fact, what is called the intersecting dynamics of inequality. So gender intersecting with race, with ethnicity, with age. And this understanding of intersectionality, which of course is a very, very central concept to feminism or feminist literature, brings out these persistent inequalities, systemic inequalities that are baked into any society. And sometimes we're simply surprised to see them because we forget. But what the world saw, for example, on the Katrina, Hurricane Katrina in the U.S., brought out a shocking image of intersectionality. So all of a sudden, the world realized it was not the women who were most vulnerable and suffered the impacts of Katrina, but it was the group where intersecting race, ability or disability, and class all of a sudden showed its ugly picture. So understanding these systemic inequalities is really important, and that's really where the climate science is now, drawing attention not just to women or gender, but how gender intersects with these other dimensions of inequality.
You've also talked about embodied experiences of climate change. What do you mean by that?
Well, embodied experiences is a term that is particularly dear to me, and I'll have to explain why that is. So most of the climate science, if you want, that looks at, well, observed impacts of climate change relies very heavily on meteorological data, right? So this is the quintessential source of information that we climate scientists can draw upon to understand whether or not the climate is in fact changing, or whether it's variability, or if there is an increase in extreme events whatsoever. So the emphasis has been on meteorological data. Now, most of my work has been in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, and the availability of climate stations is distinctly less significant than in North America or Europe, for example. So in the absence of good climate data, it's really important to look for other types of evidence. And what we see is that climate change is, of course, not just experienced through meteorological data, but through impacts on people's daily lives, on what they do, how they can do it. And that, of course, includes embodied experiences, what people feel on their bodies. And, you know, we often have a hard time illustrating that these other types of knowledge matter and that they count, and they should count more, especially if we don't have a density of climate records that shows, that demonstrates what really happens on the ground. And let me give you an example, or two examples, as a matter of fact. So embodied experiences means what people, men, women, girls, boys, feel on their bodies. We know in the literature and from case studies, from the work I've done, that very often girls and women are less likely to learn how to swim. This is particularly true in urban areas where female bodies need to be covered, protected. And so if you have not had the privilege to learn how to swim as a woman, as a girl, yes, you're certainly more vulnerable in the case of a flood or a storm surge. So that's an embodied experience. I know, for example, my work in Bangladesh has shown that in rural areas, there's a lot of emphasis on getting boys and girls trained to swim early on, and I find this is remarkable. In city areas, it's not quite the same. The other example, and this is where embodied experiences exceed simply climate stressors, comes from Lagos, Nigeria. This is not my own work, but a fantastic geographer by the name of Idowu Ajibade has done her work there. And so what she finds is that the mortality of infants is very high in particular areas of Lagos. These areas are socioeconomically disadvantaged and also politically and institutionally. So these are squatter settlements. And the study shows very nicely that during a massive rainfall event in 2011, women in the poor areas, in the disadvantaged areas, were more vulnerable Why? Well, it turns out, and you know, that seems complicated, but this is what intrinsic vulnerability means. It turns out that in Lagos, there is a requirement that women who seek obstetric care, in this case, pregnant women who want to deliver their babies, need to bring their husband to the clinic, and there is a mandatory blood donation policy that requires the husband to donate blood. In the case that Achibade investigated, well, the husband was Muslim and said, you know, he cannot do that. He cannot donate blood. That's haram, a sin against God. And so he offered, however, to pay. But the clinic said, well, you know, if everybody paid, then the policy would not be effective. And so the pregnant woman had to return home and had to deliver her baby in her, well, poorly protected house, and the baby died. So this is what intrinsic vulnerability means. People who are marginalized, who don't have access to facilities. In this case, a policy that clearly disadvantages poor women, that shows what we call systemic violence against women, that does not allow the woman to deliver her baby during a rainstorm in safe environments. Why? Because the blood goes to rich cancer patients in the richer areas of Lagos. That's what an embodied experience of climate change is. I hope this makes sense.
It does indeed. And I loved your stories, although I hated what you told. I mean, it's rather sad. But it's not just women. You've said more men perished during deadly Hurricane Mitch in Central America. Why?
There is actually a misconception that, and this is a statement that has been circulated in the literature and policy domains for years now, which goes back to actually an unsubstantiated claim. And the claim is the following. It says that women are 14 times more likely to die in natural calamities, which seems horrific. Well, what we found during the work we have done, including myself with colleagues for the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, on the fifth assessment report, was to actually show that this is only true when these women are also, as I said earlier, socioeconomically disadvantaged, and when disasters actually exacerbate existing patterns of discrimination. So it's not true that in general more women die than men. When we look at disadvantage, what we also find, and this is actually now responding to your question, indeed, there is good evidence that more men died during Hurricane Mitch. Why? Because, and there are other examples, it's not just from Central America. We find that actually across areas where masculinity and the expected role of man to be heroic and lifesavers puts them at risk. So that's true for the floods, because the men were expected to be brave and to go out there and save the women and the kids. That's really deeply entrenched in the culture of machismo. But even here in Australia, and I've only lived here for 2 years, but what strikes me here is this expectation about male roles and masculinities is very much present here too. Different, of course, than the case of machismo, but there is very well documented evidence that more men in Australia died, committed suicide, as a result of the 10-year drought, millennium drought. Well, why is that? Well, because in Australia, there exists a very strong hype, if you want, around the resilience of Australian farmers, right? An Australian farmer is supposed to be the man. It's supposed to be strong and tough and resilient and just suck it all up and roll with the punches. Well, it turned out that many men were just simply overwhelmed with the tasks they had to take on during the 10-year drought, for example, slaughtering their own frail animals. But because of that expectation to be strong and be heroic, many men felt shame about feeling inside themselves that they were just simply not able to live up to the standards that society, the media, the policies imposed on them. and were reluctant to seek help among their friends and certainly wouldn't go to see medical help. And that, of course, results in a terrible, terrible, terrible outcome and statistic. So looking at the roles people are expected to play in their society, gender roles, helps us to better understand why certain groups, men and women, are vulnerable, at risk, and potentially at risk of taking their own lives.
You know, Petra, I've traveled abroad, including in developing countries, and I was struck by the challenges millions face having to work or starve, basically, even while in poor health. I mean, a woman may have malaria or other diseases, but she's still expected to gather firewood, crops, or work in a factory and care for children. Talk to us about the intersection of health and climate change.
Oh, that's an interesting question. So maybe I can explain what I currently work on and how this relates to the intersection of health and climate change. And as you know, I don't have a medical background, and I also don't work in occupational health, so this is not my main area of expertise. But let me nonetheless explain why this is really important. So under the Climate Change Convention, UNFCCC, there is now something called the Warsaw International Mechanism on Loss and Damage, short WIM. And that's important because countries to the convention, and of course scientists as well, realize that adaptation and mitigation are not enough, that people already experience impacts. Some of them result in damages that are reversible, but some of them result in loss, and the understanding is that loss is not reversible. Now, a significant portion of what is considered loss and damage cannot be easily quantified, assessed in quantitative terms, and certainly cannot be measured in monetary values, right, with a dollar sign. And that includes health and other elements like identity, sense of place, sense of belonging, knowledge, and so on. So I'm leading a group of researchers from other universities in Australia, well, including UWA, other Australian universities, as well as partners in Africa, Europe, and the United States, on something we call intangible, invisible losses due to climate change. And what we find is that very often, and it doesn't matter what the context is, developing countries, developed countries, global north, global south, whatever terms you want to use, high-income countries, low-income countries, we find that often people are trying to protect what, of course, they value most. And we find that what people tend to value most is their identity, their livelihood, for example, as a farmer, particularly as a farmer, but we also find that for fisher folks, for example, at the expense of their own health. So the case study on Australia with a male suicide, of course, is an extreme example. But we also find that, for example, in the UK during the heat wave, European heat wave, and we found that elderly people often downplayed the risk of the heat wave, you know, kind of dismissing it as, well, it's short anyway, and it's not that hot, and, oh, we like the sun. Why? Because they were afraid that their independence possibly would be taken away and that they would be, by their children, grandchildren, shoved off to retirement homes where they would lose their identity and independence and also their dignity. But at the same time, they put their health at risk. We find the same with elderly residents in Southern Australia in the case of floods. Floods are often downplayed, dismissed as, well, you know, it's short, it's just short, it's just 15 minutes, and we just mop it up afterwards, even though people understand that their health may suffer. So what we find is that to protect what matters most to people, and that's not to say that people don't understand that health matters, but what matters most in the immediate term often is to preserve your identity, independence, dignity, while undermining the long-term effects that are indeed threatening people's own health.
We did see that also, I think, in India, where so many farmers there, rather than giving up farming when they ran into difficulties, committed suicide even using fertilizer or pesticides.
That's true.
They wanted to hold on. They were going to be farmers or they were going to die, basically, is the way they felt about it.
I think you're absolutely right. And when I was in my 20s, you can hear from my accent, I'm neither American nor Australian. I'm from Austria originally. So I worked in my 20s for an Austrian development agency, NGO, in Senegal. And I was just hugely impressed and very humbled with the hardship many people have to take on to eke out a living on a daily basis. And these are the people that we consider the poor and the vulnerable, and we did that also in our IPCC chapter, right? It's about ordinary people who, again, face the brunt of discrimination and inequalities and exclusion in their own society. And, you know, I thought I wouldn't have it in me to do what these men and women have done and did on a daily basis. And I think there's lots for us to learn from how we survive and what matters and what we want to protect that many of us have lost in an era of capitalism, globalization, consumerism. I am always deeply humbled working in the field and learning from people on the ground. And I think we need more of that in science.
Petra Checkert, what is it like in Assam, India, and particularly for women there?
Well, I've worked on a project that is called HICAP, the Himalayan Climate Change Adaptation Program, which is a co-production between agencies in Norway and ISIMOD in Nepal. And my work in Assam has been hugely influenced by collaborations with an NGO, Aranyak, that works with local communities on the ground. And the communities I worked with all experience increased risk of flooding. So you have to imagine Assam is in the northeastern part of India, and the Brahmaputra is the biggest river in this part of the country and has, of course, multiple tributaries that come from the highlands, the Himalayas. So the communities I worked with are all located on tributaries to the Brahmaputra, and clearly they are already located in vulnerable, risk-prone environments, right? So often we hear the critique saying, you know, why is it that people settle in risk-prone areas that are susceptible to flooding? In parenthesis, subtext, well, why are they so stupid to settle there? Well, it turns out that in most cases, people who settled there had no other access to any other land. Again, you know, these are disadvantaged, in this case, indigenous groups, ethnic groups, like the Missing, who tried to settle on more safer land, more productive land, but didn't get access. So the only areas left to settle and to farm and eke out a living were the flood-prone environments. And it turns out that these particular communities, over time, actually developed an enormously intrinsic understanding of the river, the tributaries, the floods, and so on, and found actually impressive, creative ways to protect themselves, houses on stilts and all that. Well, nonetheless, now with climate change, the frequency and the intensity of floods, of course, increases, and so these communities are at enormous risk. What's interesting about the gender dimensions here, and I have to tell another story, you know, the stuff is rich, so we don't just have data and we plot them. These are rich interviews, conversations, group discussions, drawings, mappings that result in this rich understanding that I think we need to bring to the fore. So what happened was that we worked with communities to develop a longer-term flood management plan, and it was an incredible amount of work that produced a preliminary map of ideas, priorities that community members wanted to take on, some of which they could do on their own, and others for which they needed help from the government, the Disaster Risk Management Agency. And so we then organized a meeting with the disaster risk managers, other people from the government, media, teachers, and community representatives. And as you can imagine, the community representatives were all men, the male elite, who, to their credit, did a fantastic job critiquing the governmental risk managers for not protecting them sufficiently. We were incredibly impressed and incredibly proud that people who usually don't have a voice to speak, who are not even invited to these meetings, stood up with the maps they had produced to tell their story and to request that the government takes care of them because they're just, well, they're citizens like everybody else. At the same time, however, the same men that we just admired during the meetings would not allow women representatives on their community committee to increase and enhance climate resilience because their argument was, well, women don't read and write and hence they shouldn't be on the committee. So what we see is a really complex story of what we call the micropolitics of climate change adaptation. Adaptation is not just about implementing a technological measure like building a dam or an embankment or improving crops. It's about all the, if you want, the soft, the fluffy elements of how decisions are made and the processes of negotiating trade-offs and sacrifices. And we were deeply disappointed that the same male elite didn't want to see women represented. So adaptation is a process. And my work, I think, and I hope, contributes to facilitating these processes so adaptation becomes more inclusive so that all members of society, whether they're men or women or whatever ethnic group or class we talk about, have a seat at the table.
We hardly ever hear climate activists talk about the role of patriarchy in producing a fossil-powered society and wrecking the climate in the meanwhile. Are men the problem?
Yes and no. I think there's a lot of interesting work happening right now. So, you know, one argument, of course, is that the focus on fossil fuels, on technology, on technocratic solutions, science, and on security, of course, all, if you want, represents kind of the traditional domain of man. And they do represent what we call, you know, a hegemonic masculinity, a dominant masculinity that embraces strength and power and, of course, technology and fossil fuels. That's all part of it. I have a good colleague here in Australia, in Perth. Her name is Naomi Godden. And she did some really interesting work on how Australia represents itself at UN meetings, but also in climate campaigns. And what she did, and I think that will help me to answer your question, is she looked at the statements of Australia at the Conference of the Parties to the UNFCCC. And she just analyzed keywords in there. And what she found was that, and that's the message of the Australian government, that the highest percentage, 25% of whatever is in Australian statements is on economy, business, and market, 12 on the environment, 9 on technology. So those are the domineering fields, economy, business, market, technology. Gender never appeared in the Australian policy statement. At the level of the Australian campaigns, it's interesting to see that the largest representation of words, concepts, 30%, is income and livelihoods, and then health, and clearly less on technology, even though women are still underrepresented. So what that means is that we are so used to embrace this technocratic, masculine discourse that pushes, that favorizes technocratic, technological solutions, the fossil fuel industry. And we overlook how this, well, patriarchy, that technocratic discourse, that market-based climate discourse, dismisses and makes invisible and discounts justice, decision-making, equality, everything which is considered more feminine, even though we know from an adaptation standpoint and from how we ought to increase resilience that these are the lenses, the entry points we need. We need more attention to what I explained earlier, these systematic and systemic inequalities. And it's only by resolving these inequalities and reducing them that I think all of us, whether that's in Australia, Canada, U.S., Bangladesh, Burkina Faso, we have a better chance to protect ourselves from climate change and the negative impacts and increase our resilience.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock from the University of Western Australia. Our guest is Professor Petra Chackert. We're talking about the challenges of climate change, especially for women. And I'm Alex Smith. Petra, can feminism help provide a better response to climate change?
I would say absolutely yes, and that is for two reasons. So the first one is feminism, well, just as women and climate change, has come a long way. I think many people misunderstand what feminism means today. Yes, it certainly did start as advancing, ensuring equal opportunities and rights, political, economic, social rights for women, but it is much more than that today. It is precisely about racism, sexism, class oppression, and pointing out how sexism, racism, class oppression, disadvantage in any society constructs, builds, and shapes and defines people who are then vulnerable. And so picking apart how these drivers intersect to create vulnerabilities provides us with a lens to better find solutions for climate change. That's one. The second one, and that's a little bit more on the scientific side, is that feminism, of course, has also contributed to how we do science, and that includes epistemologies. Epistemologies, well, we use that term to mean what knowledge counts, what knowledge is relevant, where does that knowledge come from, at what scale do we look for this type of knowledge, and how it is constructed. And so feminist epistemologies help us to count different types of knowledge, to validate different types of knowledge, in addition to the climate data that I mentioned earlier and the climate stations. Feminist epistemologies allow us to look at exactly these embodied experiences that men and women around the world have, experiences and evidence that so far and often has been discounted as not scientific, as subjective. And I think feminist epistemologies help us to bring all evidence we have to the fore, because clearly we want to provide the best evidence we can, and we fully recognize that every method we use, whether that's quantitative data or qualitative data, whether that's meteorological records, or rich accounts of women and men as we encounter them in the communities, all of them are needed, because each of them individually will always be partial, incomplete, and hence insufficient to provide a case. I see that now on the work I am invited to do again with the IPCC on the special report for global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius. We are encouraged to look for diverse pieces of evidence and experiences to allow us to share the best evidence we have across all scales, from the body to the global atmospheric level.
Well, from the few people I've talked to, it seems like 1.5 is almost in the rearview mirror. It happened for about a month in 2016, and it looks like it's just going to happen more and more. So when will the report come out?
The report will come out in September, late September 2018. Now, the 1.5 is an interesting story. The parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change actually requested it from the scientists, from the IPCC, and that happened last year in March, I think. And so the reason for that is the last assessment report of the IPCC was mandated to focus on 2 and 4 degrees warming, so not on 1.5. But of course, with with increasing evidence, we realized that more knowledge on 1.5 is imperative. So the teams that have just now, last week, been selected to contribute to this report on 1.5 will work with just 18 months of time to produce, well, the best evidence that they can find. Keep in mind that 1.5, of course, is a global average that includes data from across continents and the oceans. And we're thinking about 1.5 not as just one time crossing it in one particular location, but really as a global average. Now, the work I do on the ground with farmers in Ghana or in Assam or in Nepal, of course, shows us that people are not concerned about a global average. They're concerned about what they experience on a daily basis. And on a daily basis, we are way beyond 1.5 in many places on the planet. Archbishop Tutu once said, I heard him say that in Copenhagen at the COP in 2009, he said, you know, a warming degree of 1.5 or 2 means at least 3 for the African continent, and hence means cooking the continent. So we have to realize that the global average, that of course is important to climate scientists as, well, an accumulated data set from all stations, plays out very differently in real places, in real lives. I think the report will show both the impacts that we can expect on a 1.5 global average, again, with distinctly higher temperatures in specific places, but also the measures that need to be put in place urgently to make sure that we don't cross it, or even if we do, and many people do believe we will, then what consequences that may have and who ought to be held accountable.
Whoa, that's a big one. Well, look, we're starting to run out of time, I'm sorry to say, but I have to ask, is that 1.5 really pre-industrial, like from 1750, or is it set from a later date?
It always refers to pre-industrial times.
We've been visiting with Professor Petra Checkert from the University of Western Australia in Perth. Petra is a geographer with a specialty in marginalized people and ways to build resilience to climate change. You can find links for this conversation in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for spending time with us, Petra.
It was a pleasure, Alex. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
We interrupt this program for a storm warning.
City officials have declared a snow emergency in New York City.
Overcome by heat. Residents across Buenos Aires are grappling with soaring temperatures of more than 38 degrees Celsius. The heat wave has put severe strain on Argentina's electricity grid. Authorities have issued a red alert and many people living in high-rise buildings are being evacuated.
At least part of the reported 34 tornadoes that swept through this nation's midsection.
If you watch television news or track Google News, you can notice a new phenomenon sneaking up on all of us. Along with a war somewhere, a murder or fire and the political chatter, there is an almost constant background of weather news. There used to be a little weather forecast later, after the real news, you know? Perhaps it featured a beautiful woman who was or was not a meteorologist. More recently, that weather porn, as we call it, has moved out of the background into primetime news coverage. In the first week of February, for example, cities on the east coast of the United States went from 70-degree t-shirt weather to a foot or more of snow overnight. Canada's hotspot of Vancouver has received more snow than the big winter regions further east. Almost every area is getting strange weather, bigger storms. For the Australians, it's still more extreme heat for their February summer. Are we becoming acclimatized to climate change? Apparently, we can tolerate continuing record-set and out-of-the-ordinary, never-before-seen weather events as the new normal. We're all interested in the weather, and now we have so much more of it. It's becoming like our fascination with death, climate disruption, as entertainment.
It's time we accept bad weather as a vital natural resource, one we as a nation should be proud of.
Keep in mind, we are only at the beginning of this great experiment with the Earth's atmosphere. Due to a time lag built into the ocean system, The changes we see now reflect greenhouse gas emissions from around the year 2000. We've greatly increased emissions into the atmosphere since then, as the developing world flips over into fossil civilizations. At some point, the tornado, hurricane, storm surge, heat wave, or extreme fire arrives near you. After the first response of helping however you can, comes an opportunity to raise awareness. Why is this happening? Are humans amping up the weather? Is this a ramp where we accelerate into a different climate? More and more scientists I talk with think this is our only chance to avoid a complete climate catastrophe. When extreme and unexplainable weather hits each region, then somehow local organization for climate action, you and I, we have to develop it, and we have to take power. That's right, I said take power. Currently in the United States and in Australia and previously in Canada, a gang of industrialist climate deniers took power. We need to right the ship so that science and common experience can be the guide of government. Climate power, when do we need it? Well, we need it in 1975, but there is still time to retain a habitable place on this planet. We need climate power now. You can begin as the climate deniers began, at the local level. Start with local school boards to ensure children are taught the scientific truth. Start with local government to build resilience for your community. Tough as it is, we also have to bring our family, neighbors, and workmates on board. Then go for the bigger layers of government to kick out the climate deniers. I am not a political person. I would much rather be gardening and enjoying life with the people I love. I want to avoid politics. But now we can't. We can't leave unbalanced people to steer this ship. We can't let short-term greed rule the day. It is already so late now, we cannot duck out of any opportunity, large or small, for climate action. It is not enough just to listen to Radio EcoShock. Sure, please share this show. It does help. But we need to complete the chain from ears to brain to action. How does weather activism become climate activism? Talk among yourselves.
Radio EcoShock.
What if climate change washed more of a certain neurotoxin into the oceans? What could happen to ocean life or to us? Are you ready to explore? Our guide is a scientist in Sweden, Dr. Erik Bjorn, is a chemist and biochemist in the Marine Sciences Lab at Umeå University. He's a researcher and co-author of a paper that might not go far in the newspapers or TV, but it is news, and I think it's big news. Erik Bjorn, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Your paper describes more and more organic material running into the sea as the climate shifts. Why will that happen?
So basically, this will happen because of increased precipitation, rainfall, in certain regions of the world. And this increased rainfall will then basically wash out more organic matter from soils to aquatic ecosystems.
How much more will flow into the ocean? I mean, is this a big process or a slight increase?
It's projected to be very different for different regions of the world where climate scientists are working with different climate scenarios, but the one that we are mainly discussing in the paper projects changes from 50% decreases in runoff up to 50% increases in runoff for different parts of the world by the end of this century as compared to the conditions today or a decade ago. So a large range for different regions in the world.
Were you able to add it up globally so we know whether there's a net increase or decrease?
I have to confess that I don't know that for sure.
Okay. Now, we're going to talk about a chemical called methylmercury. What is that?
So basically, it is a organic mercury compound. I mean, mercury is an element, of course, that occurs naturally. And which is spread to ecosystems both by natural processes and by anthropogenic activities. And in the environment, mercury can be transformed to this organic form, methylmercury, by certain types of microorganisms. And methylmercury is a strong nevrotoxic compound, which can then be accumulated in aquatic food webs to high concentrations in top predators.
You know, humans always want to hear about themselves first. So what is the impact of methylmercury on human health?
The major impact is that since it is a nevrotoxic compound, it causes those type of various types, I should say, of nevrotoxic effects. And of course, as often, infants and children are most vulnerable, and it can negatively affect learning abilities and IQ for children. So it is a severe toxic compound, and it's, for example, classified by the World Health Organization as one of the top 10 chemicals of public health concern. Maybe I can also mention that in relation to the processes of accumulation in the aquatic food web, the main exposure route for humans to methylmercury is then through consumption of certain fish species, not all types of fish, but some fish species.
Would tuna be an example?
Tuna is one example, yes.
So what happened in Minamata, Japan, that gave this environmental poisoning a name?
So there it was actually accidentally released from a factory and contaminated a large coastal region. I mean, normally methylmercury is not released into the environment by anthropogenic processes. It is formed in the environment. But in this case, in Minamata in Japan, it was released very large amounts of methylmercury to a coastal area, contaminating the fish in that ecosystem that a lot of people were eating.
Two things surprised me right off the bat about your work. The first is the location of your university. For those who don't know, Umeå University is in central to northern Sweden, up along river estuary from the Gulf of Bothnia, off the Baltic Sea. Why is your unit working on the health of global seawater?
I think it's important to note that the effects we are describing in this paper will not be a global phenomenon. It is an effect that might occur in certain regions and certain types of ecosystems. For example, with the level of knowledge we have today, we believe that the ecosystem in the northern Baltic Sea could be vulnerable to these effects. From what we know today, we expect that coastal regions in the northern part of the northern hemisphere, so Canada, northern United States, Scandinavia, Russia, would be the most vulnerable regions and ecosystems to these effects. So we expect that we might have this problem in our local region here in the northern Baltic Sea.
Well, that makes sense. The second surprise to me was your lab. You know, some of my guests make climate discoveries using computer models or assessing many other studies. But a video provided by the university shows you walking among large vats with a lot of measuring equipment. What is in the vats and what are you looking for?
Right, yeah. So what it is indeed an experimental study. And so what is shown in the video is the so-called Mesocosm Research Facility at the Umeå Marine Sciences Center. And basically this research facility, it consists of 12 big plastic tubes, which are about 1 meter in diameter and 5 meters high. And what we did in our study is that we filled these big black tubes with sediment at the bottom and then a 2,000-liter, 5-meter high water column. And then in this system, you can control temperature, light conditions, additions of nutrients, and then in our case also terrestrial organic matter, so that we basically, under well-controlled conditions, construct different types of aquatic model ecosystems. That's basically what this facility is designed for. And then in our case, what we did was that we added isotopically enriched mercury tracers, so stable isotopes, not radioactive isotopes, of mercury into the sediment and into the water. And then we basically studied how methylmercury was formed and how it was accumulated in the food web. So we had food webs up to zooplankton in this experiment for different types of model ecosystems.
Well, that's something that worried me in your new science. My alarm bells went off when the paper described a change taking place between zooplankton and bacteria. What did you find there?
So what we found was what happens when we add this terrestrial organic matter, as we talked before, what happens is that there is a change in the structure of the food web, because basically the water gets brown colored. So there is less light penetration through the water, which then decreases the production of phytoplankton through photosynthesis. And instead, there is an increased growth of bacteria in the water column, which of course don't need light, and they can instead directly use this organic matter, this terrestrial organic matter. And what happens then is that there is a shift or a change in the structure of the food web, so that it goes from being based on phytoplankton to being based by bacteria. When that happens, there also is, it establishes or develops a new trophic level of organisms, protozoa organisms that feed on the bacteria. So on average, there are a longer food chain when it starts with bacteria compared to when it starts with phytoplankton. So there are more steps in the food chain when it's based on bacteria. And methylmercury is enriched in each such step in the food chain. So therefore, you then eventually get higher concentrations when you reach predatory organisms such as zooplankton, and in the next step then fish.
We're talking with Dr. Erik Bjorn from the Marine Sciences Lab at Umeå University in Sweden. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. I would like to talk to you about the human sources of methylmercury. There seems to be, if you give me a second, a conflict between the information in Wikipedia and what I'm getting from your paper. Wiki says, quote, "Much, if not most, of the distributed mercury dispositional input is from natural sources. Pre-Anthropocene tissue-bound levels in fish may not have differed markedly from current levels, bringing it into question whether economically and environmentally expensive political regulatory measures would be ineffectual and moot." What are your comments on that, Erik Bjorn?
So first I would say this, we do not investigate, of course, the sources of mercury in this particular paper that we are talking about here, and would also like to note that irrespective of where the mercury is originating from, one would basically have the same effects if you have these changes in food web structure. But when it comes to the origin of mercury, there are still intense ongoing research trying to constrain the numbers on how big fraction is originating from natural sources and how big fraction is originating from anthropogenic sources. I have to admit that I haven't actually read that quote from Wikipedia. It surprises me a little bit. I would say that our current best scientific knowledge suggests that a larger fraction originates from anthropogenic sources than what was stated there.
That's what I was getting from your paper. And you also discuss there other land changes by humans which affect the runoff of even the naturally occurring methylmercury. Can you talk about those?
One example, and which we are also working with in our research groups, is the effect of forestry. For example, when forests are being clear cut, there is also an increase in runoff and also input of terrestrial organic matter and also mercury from the terrestrial landscape and to the aquatic ecosystems. So that is one such example, which is also another, focus research area for our research groups in Umeå.
And once this methylmercury hits the sea, Erik, in 1,000 places, does it stay more concentrated along the coast where most fishing occurs, or does it disperse towards some sort of balance in the oceans?
The input from the terrestrial landscape is mainly impacting the coastal zones, and exactly how large zones, of course, will vary from different regions. Then in the open oceans, the direct impact from terrestrial input, of course, is small. But still, there are significant concentrations of methylmercury in the open oceans, and it's still actually not fully clarified what the origin of that methylmercury is. If it is formed in the ocean water by the same or similar processes and microorganisms as it's formed in soils and sediment, or if it is through other mechanisms. So that's also an important and still unresolved research question.
Interesting. Well, now that we know about this process and its possible increase under climate change, is there anything we can do about it?
In our study, we do not reach a stage where we propose any specific actions directed towards this specific phenomenon. Since it is a general phenomenon in the type of regions where it would occur, it's, at least for me, a bit difficult to see what effective specific actions one could do to direct this specific process. So what we would emphasize is the need to reduce anthropogenic mercury emissions, which hopefully will be the case through the implementation of the Minamata Treaty, a big international legally binding treaty, which is signed by, I think, more than 130 countries now, with the intent to largely reduce anthropogenic mercury emissions, which I would say are very large contributions to the total mercury emissions. And the second thing, of course, to minimize the impact on changes in the future climate.
Yes, and I would have to say as a climate activist myself that the coal plants are a large source of mercury into the environment. And if those happen to close down because of, say, the Paris Accords or other reasons, that might also help the situation.
Yes, when it comes to coal combustion, I think it's also, with respect to mercury emissions, it is promising that there is now developed technology to remove mercury from the flue gases before they are emitted. So there, I would say we have the technology to a very large extent remove that source of mercury emissions.
Is there anything else you would like to say to our listeners?
I think we could talk about this for a long time. Maybe I would add how we look upon this study that we have made is that we believe that we are contributing with a new piece of very important knowledge in order to be able to predict how global climate changes in the future might affect the exposure of toxic methyl mercury, both to ecosystems and to humans. And this is something that we think that will be important to use both for scientists and for policymakers. And we ourselves are continuing quite intense research work in this direction.
We've been talking with Dr. Erik Bjorn, and the paper in the journal Science Advances is titled Terrestrial Discharges Mediate Trophic Shifts and Enhance Methylmercury Accumulation in Estuarine Biota. It was published January 27, 2017. You can find links to that paper and everything we have talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Erik, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.